loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening. It's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The saying goes that in war, the first casualty is the truth. That's a cliche, also true. While the corporate media reports that Aleppo has fallen, many Syrians consider the city has been liberated. The momentous development came just before the assassination of Russia's ambassador to Turkey, Andrei Karlov, and the following day, the watershed summit between Turkey, Russia, and Iran on the issue of Syria, a summit to which the United States and John Kerry in particular were not invited. Today, we are joined from Ontario, Canada, by one such journalist who has been covering this story, Eva Bartlett. She has visited Syria 6 times, including a recent trip in which she was in Aleppo. We are also joined by journalist John White. We're talking to him from Scotland. He is the host of Radio Sputnik's weekly show, Hard Facts. And we are joined by Walter Smolarek. He is the producer of this show, Loud and Clear, and Walter is here in studio. Welcome, Eva, John, and Walter.
Thank you.
Hi, great to be with you.
Hi, thanks so much.
John White, let's start with you. Last Thursday, the Syrian government announced that the withdrawal of the last pockets of the so-called rebel fighters from Aleppo, that the entire city was again under the control of the government and forces loyal to it. The New York Times reported on this with a headline saying, "Turning point in Syria as Assad regains all of Aleppo." Is this the beginning of the end of the war?
I think so. I think most people who have a serious analysis of the conflict and who've been analysing the conflict from the beginning agree on that, that this was a major turning point. Pro-government forces now have significant momentum. However, it's far from over. We saw ISIS being able to retake Palmyra just at the conclusion of the operation to liberate Aleppo, which shows that there's going to be a lot of fighting left to do. The eastern Syrian city of Deir ez-Zor still remains besieged, as it has done for the last 4 or 5 years. And of course, Raqqa is still controlled by ISIS. And then obviously Idlib, adjacent to Aleppo, is controlled by opposition forces. So there's still a long way to go, but I do think that we see light at the end of the tunnel. And I do think that it's now only a matter of time. And all sides now, I think, are starting to look at the post-conflict situation in Syria, or certainly the post-this conflict situation, and how things are going to play out, because I don't believe that the West has yet relinquished its objective of the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. I think they're still ideologically committed. Obviously, the Trump presidency will be key in this regard, but certainly deep state elements in Washington remain committed to this, as does European governments in the West.
Eva Bartlett, you've been in Syria, you've been in Aleppo. The U.S. government and the U.S. media are portraying the evacuation from eastern Aleppo of al-Qaeda and al-Nusra, or the same perhaps, and other terrorist forces as a dreadful nightmare, as a crime, as one of the great crimes of the Syrian war. I mean, it's very odd when you hear the U.S. government echoed by the mainstream media, and it is, of course, an echo chamber, talking about the eviction of al-Qaeda-related forces as a catastrophe. But what do you think in terms of the people in Aleppo? Of course, I'm presuming you were in western Aleppo. There are differences in eastern Aleppo demographically and in terms of social and class issues. But what's your sense of the mood in Aleppo?
Yeah, I mean, when I was there twice in November, at that point, Aleppo still was under eastern parts of Aleppo were still under the control of different militant factions, including those that the West refuses to call, as they should be called, terrorists, like Nuruddin al-Zinki, as well as, of course, al-Nusra. And at that time, in November, I mean, on a daily basis, the civilians in greater Aleppo, so over 1.5 million people that, you know, corporate media disappeared and refused to talk about, were still being, those people were still being hammered on a daily basis by the different bombs and missiles of these terrorist factions in eastern areas of Aleppo. So, you know, over the years, the media has not reported the suffering of these people and the at least 11,000 people in greater Aleppo who were killed by such bombings and snipings. And then, you know, you fast forward to the present, and Aleppo is now completely secured by all reports coming from Aleppo. And we're one to follow simply CNN or other, you know, MSM corporate media. One wouldn't even be aware that people are on the streets celebrating. And one recent example, we're almost at Christmas, and I have, you know, various friends in Aleppo posting images and videos of people celebrating not only the liberation of Aleppo, but also, you know, massive displays of Christmas trees and celebrations for Christmas. And people who are trying to discount the reality of the fact that most people in Aleppo are overjoyed and liberated. You know, Aleppo is in a Christian city, so these are manufactured images or something like that. And the fact is, yes, Aleppo is predominantly Sunni, which is an important point in itself. But, you know, throughout Syria, what I've seen and what other people who actually go to Syria and talk with Syrians will see is that whether, you know, Muslim or Christian, Syrians celebrate one another's holidays. They don't have this sectarian ideology that comes largely from the Gulf states and Turkey and is promoted by the West. So if you're in Aleppo, even though it is predominantly Sunni, you will find people, Sunnis and Christians, celebrating Christmas. So, you know, going back to your question, on the ground, we have colleagues like Vanessa Bealey, who's just now returned to Aleppo, and she was there while it was being in the final stages of liberation, and she was interviewing people, as I had interviewed people who had escaped from eastern Aleppo or were rescued by the Syrian Arab Army from eastern Aleppo. And what she was hearing and what our media is not reporting and what I also heard when I interviewed families that had escaped was that they didn't want these militant factions there, that they were suffering greatly at the hands of these militant factions that were starving them, that were forcibly preventing them from leaving. And now that Aleppo is liberated, Vanessa is back there, and it would be quite interesting to see what she is reporting, because I'm positive it's going to corroborate the reports of Syrian journalists on the ground, like Mohammed Ali of Press TV, of journalists with Russia Today or with Ruptly, and of Syrians themselves who are saying, you know, with the liberation of Aleppo, we now have stability, almost. They almost have stability. And I say almost because militant factions outside of Aleppo still are able to fire onto the city. And just today on the state media, Sana, I saw that a rocket killed 3 people and injured 6 more in Aleppo, and the numbers could be higher. So the point is, you know, our media is completely distorting the reality, because if they were to report accurately and honestly that the majority of the people in Aleppo are overjoyed at the return of security and stability to their city, this runs in stark contrast to what we've been told since day one, that there is a moderate rebel uprising against, and of course with all the sectarian terms, against the Syrian president. This is a myth that even so-called progressive media in the West continues to purport, and I will name one of these outlets, and that's Democracy Now. They continue to put forth this notion that there ever was a moderate uprising in Syria, and that it was of secular nature, and that, you know, that some of these so-called rebels are moderate. So you go to Aleppo, you talk with the people, and, you know, the vast majority, if not all, well, we'll say the vast majority, will say, these so-called rebels are terrorists because they commit the same acts. So I think I would really encourage people, you know, if you find Press TV or Russia Today, if, you know, some people say, well, these are Iranian and Russian state media. I beg to differ, because there are independent journalists working on the ground who happen to report to these different agencies. But if people don't want to take them as credible, fine. Look at the writings of Vanessa Bealey. Look at the writings of Pierre Lecorse, who is an independent Frenchman living in Aleppo. And you will see that what they're saying corroborates exactly with what Press TV, what Russia Today, and what Syrian reporters are saying in Aleppo.
Let's bring Walter Smolarek into the discussion. Walter, I was reading a piece entitled The Fall of Eastern Aleppo by the author is Polat Khan. He's a leader of the YPG, the Kurdish Protection Units. Obviously, the Kurds have been in struggle with the central Syrian government, the Assad government. They have their own agenda, which has been either autonomy or even possibly independence for Kurdistan. I mean, they say they're not fighting for independence, that they're fighting for autonomy. At times, they've been fierce opponents of the Syrian government, involved in military clashes. At times, they have been, and even recently, fighting along with U.S. forces in northern Syria. And at times, they have been kind of partners with the Syrian government in the struggle against al-Qaeda and against ISIS. They analyze in this piece about the fall of Aleppo initially in 2012, and then the retaking of of Aleppo just last week. I think it's important to bring their analysis into it because they're not apologists for the Assad government. They are, in fact, have been opponents of the Assad government while at the same time finding some partnership with the Assad government. But here's what they say. Aleppo is divided into two districts, eastern and western Aleppo, which is not only a geographical division, but a social and cultural one. Eastern Aleppo is home for the poor, devout, and pious Sunnis, Kurds from villages Kobani and Afrin, and also Turks. All are poor and working class from construction and textile industries. On the other hand, Western Aleppo is home for the middle class government employees, the rich, and the landlords who don't care about political slogans and only look for stability in order to survive. Then this statement goes on. The fall of Eastern Aleppo in 2012 was not because of internal dynamics or self-development. It was the result of the occupation of by armed villagers north of Aleppo. Sixth, the Islamic factions fought and destroyed prominent families and tribes in eastern Aleppo. And once the Islamic factions took control of eastern Aleppo, they stole and looted everything and exported it to Turkey for very low prices, leading to the destruction of the economy and employment opportunities that people rely on them for existence. That's an important statement, I think, because it shows some of the nuance and the issues that are involved in eastern Aleppo. But it clearly shows, and again, these are the YPG, not political groupies, say, of Assad, saying this wasn't a revolt at all in eastern Aleppo. It was an armed invasion from outside.
Yeah, I definitely think that's an important point. I mean, certainly were there people in Aleppo who had grievances with the Ba'ath Party government led by Bashar al-Assad in Aleppo? Yeah, I think that's certainly true. But these Salafist factions, these extremist Islamist political forces, I think the YPG is correct, and this is something that we hear from other analysts. Those types of political forces were not indigenous to Aleppo. You know, Aleppo was a relatively economically thriving city. You know, it was the manufacturing hub of Syria. Of course, there was, you know, great class divisions as there are in all class societies. But, you know, to return to your earlier point about the alignment of the YPG, I think the point that they raise about how, you know, the properties, the personal belongings of these prominent Sunni families were exported to Turkey for very low prices, important because that's another piece of the geopolitical puzzle. The Turkish state sees Kurdish autonomy and certainly Kurdish independence as an existential threat. You know, even more, you know, Assad must go, right, is sort of a reach. It's like an offensive policy by the Erdogan government. But in terms of like their own internal state security, they view the crushing of the Kurdish movement as like the top priority to which all other priorities are subordinate. And so when we see that the Islamist factions that invaded Aleppo are exporting these looted goods to Turkey, I think it betrays that alliance that they have, that these extreme Salafist factions are backed by Turkey. They're also backed by Saudi Arabia and other authoritarian, to put it mildly, Gulf states, monarchies, absolute monarchies. And so the Kurds, of course, are not going to form like a full alliance or really an alliance of any sort with these forces.
John White, what do you think about all that?
Yeah, that's I think that's these are cogent points that Walter just makes. I think when the history of this conflict and crisis is written, I think Erdogan will be the biggest victim. This man, his policy has been underpinned by opportunism all the way through. Because when Erdogan, as Walter mentioned, called for Assad to go, this was not driven by any principle on his part. This was driven by expediency, because he felt, as others did in the region and out with the region in the West, that Assad was going to go the same way as Gaddafi went. And so they were jockeying for position and influence, and to gain some kind of credibility with the Syrian people, who they felt this was going to morph into a popular revolution, and it never did. It was only ever a localized uprising. There were people who have legitimate grievances with their government and had legitimate grievances with their government, but the vast majority of those are now standing with their government because they understand the difference between reform and ruin. And so Erdogan, I think, his country is in deep, deep crisis. He saw a way to bolster his power and influence in the region and by so doing his influence with the West, becoming the main regional power and gaining thereby the emoluments from Washington and so forth that Egypt had gained under Mubarak and Israel and so forth. And this is now blown back in his face. And I don't think many people will have much sympathy for him. We've just seen the assassination of Russia's ambassador to Turkey, Andriy Karlov. And I interviewed recently a Turkish journalist who said that, you know, Erdogan is not a serious partner in combating terrorism with Russia. Russia has to deal with Erdogan because of the strategic location of Turkey, but it's not a serious partner. He's speaking out of two sides of his mouth at the same time, trying to appease a rising Islamist sentiment in Turkey that exists, and also giving a different message to Moscow and others who he feels support he needs in order to bolster his international status. So I think Erdogan's going to be the biggest victim of this, and I don't think many people will feel sorry for him in that regard.
All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to be back in a minute. We're talking about the fall of Aleppo, meaning the liberation of Aleppo. It's the fall of Aleppo in the mainstream media here, the liberation of Aleppo for Syria, of course, and for the people who live in Aleppo. We're talking with John White, Eva Bartlett, and Walter Smolarek. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking about the liberation of Aleppo and the forecast for the Syria war, the war that has raged on since 2011. Hundreds of thousands of people are dead. Millions have been made into refugees. A unitary country has been divided and fragmented. Western powers, regional powers who are their proxies and allies, have done so much to fund a war against the Assad government, to funnel fighters and money and weapons into that country. We're talking with John White. He is the show host of Hard Facts on Radio Sputnik. We're talking with Eva Bartlett. She's an independent journalist who has been to Syria multiple times, including to Aleppo. And we're joined in our Washington, D.C. studio by Walter Smolarek. He is the show host of this show, Loud and Clear. Eva Bartlett, I want to try to talk about the geostrategic impact of Syria because, or the possible end of the Syrian war with the Assad government still in power. In 2003, the United States invaded Iraq. We all know that. We know what happened. A million Iraqis, according to the Lancet Medical Journal, died who would not have otherwise died. Millions more were wounded. Again, millions of refugees. A lot of them went to Syria. A couple million went to Syria, in fact. And many refugees from Iraq are still in Syria. But that sort of broke the Middle East apart in a way. And Saddam Hussein had said, if the U.S. does carry out this invasion, it will open the gates of hell. Then the United States, using NATO in 2011, this time not under George W. Bush, but President Obama, and with the cheerleading of Hillary Clinton, then Secretary of State, went to war against the Libyan government. And Gaddafi warned that if the United States succeeded in carrying out regime change in Libya, that it would be al-Qaeda and other Islamic terrorist organizations that would take over. That's happened. And now we have this last 5 years of war in Syria. When you look at the picture of the U.S. intervention into these countries and you see the drastic, terrible outcomes, do you think that this was just sort of reckless, feckless, small thinking by people who didn't know anything? Or was there some sort of larger plans, larger objective, because the same pattern kept repeating itself over and over? What's your take on that?
Oh, absolutely. It hasn't been reckless or haphazard. It's not like the people that have been supporting so-called rebels, even prior to 2011, they've been supporting what they call the so-called opposition. By people, I mean like bodies of the U.S. government, of Canada as well. Canada has been supporting these so-called opposition members, and now, of course, after 2011, directly supporting different terrorist factions in Syria. It's not like they didn't expect. I'm just actually looking through an article I wrote in 2015 because I wanted to be able to cite, I believe it was the DIA, their own internal document. I think it was 2012. I find it, I can quote it directly, but they essentially admit, or that, not admit, but they state that by supporting radical Islamist factions in Syria, they'll be able to achieve their goals, which was to destabilize. Here we go, I found it. So in a 2012 Department of Defense document admitted the U.S. foresaw ISIS is establishing a Salafist principality in eastern Syria. So Hasaka, Deir ez-Zor, precisely where they are. And, you know, it's not like they haven't seen this coming. And a question I think is a very good question that should be put to all these people that continue, including Democracy Now!, that continue in Channel 4, to claim that there was ever an uprising of moderate rebels. Even, for example, recently, the former UK ambassador to Syria, he was ambassador from 2003 to 2006, apparently, Peter Ford, he was recently interviewed on BBC, and I'm actually quite alarmed that they allowed him to speak so honestly, because as we know, BBC has been, from the beginning, propagating this war propaganda. But he himself makes the point that he said, we have clung for too long to the illusion that the so-called moderate opposition would overcome Assad. And he points out later on, you know, the fact that the majority of the people support Assad. And obviously, if one uses their own critical thinking, if the majority of Syrians didn't support Assad, then he wouldn't have lasted so long. But at the end of their interview, or at least of the transcript, he just says, like, who would take Assad's place? And, you know, and he makes precisely the point you just have. If the planners of this war on Syria were successful, what we'd see in Syria would be another Libya. It would be chaos. It would be certainly not freedom and democracy, certainly not human rights. And it would be these maniacs that are affiliated either with al-Nusra or, you know, child beheading Nuruddin al-Zinki or the so-called FSA, ruling pockets of Syria and, you know, destroying the country even more. I think that one thing, you know, people who do support the government and their army, well, obviously the support for the Syrian army is different than the support for the government in that the Syrian army is of the people. So logically, you're going to be supporting the army when your own uncles, brothers, fathers, etc. are in the army. The support for the government varies, but I think one factor that even people who are anti-Assad in the beginning realize is that he brings stability to the country. And, you know, the secularism under Assad and under the Syrian government certainly wouldn't exist if any of these head-chopping, you know, terrorists or moderate rebels of any of these factions were in power. So, yeah, I mean, it's I really am truly baffled that people in the so-called left continue to put forth this idea that, you know, anybody from FSA or al-Nusra or Nuruddin al-Zinki could actually bring human rights and democracy to Syria.
Walter Smolarek, I was, as in addition to being the show host of this show, Loud and Clear, I'm also the national coordinator of the Answer Coalition. During the run-up to the Iraq War, starting on October 26, 2002, when we had a demonstration of about 200,000 in Washington and then 500,000 on January 18, 2003, and then the next month was February 15, 2003, when people everywhere in the world went into the streets. And it was such a powerful anti-war movement. The New York Times at that time said there now is a second global superpower, meaning the anti-war movement. It turned out not to be exactly true, but it seemed so at the time because nothing like that had ever happened before. And yet the Bush administration raised the war, and sure enough, 3 weeks later, the Saddam government fell, the Ba'athist army was dissipated. Iraq had already been very weakened as a consequence of sanctions, because they were surrounded, because their weapons were completely inspected. They didn't have weapons of mass destruction. In other words, they were low-hanging fruit for the picking, as Lawrence Wilkerson, Colin Powell's chief of staff, said when I asked him on this show, why did you invade Iraq? He said, because it was low-hanging fruit. Anyway, it seemed like Bush was victorious at that time, and there was a sense of, you know, inspiration and joy, and Bush's approval ratings went up. And I can remember, because I found, as I was looking through our own archives just in the last couple of weeks, a flyer that we had produced in July 2003, and it was a forum that we were speaking at, and it was entitled, Is Syria Next? That was in 2003, that the U.S. had the bit in its mouth. They had succeeded in vanquishing Iraq, and now they were moving on. Was it part of a region-wide regime change strategy by the neocons? And if so, what was their goal and did they succeed?
Yeah, I think it was. You know, there was a great amount of hubris, of course, that animated the Bush administration, and especially the Bush administration's military and foreign policy team, many of whom came out of this think tank called the Project for a New American Century. And the strategic thinking basically went that, you know, the Soviet Union was overthrown, the socialist bloc had fallen, the United States now reigned alone as the global hegemon, and so they needed to remake the architecture of the Middle East, rearrange the geopolitical map, so that they would have control of the world's energy supplies and the other, you know, strategic assets that exist in the region. And that would be, to one degree or another, sort of like the bedrock for continued U.S. dominance for the rest of the century. And if we look at the U.S. military interventions carried out in the 90s under the Clinton administration, maybe there was some logic to their feelings of confidence, right? There was the destruction of Yugoslavia. There was the, well, this was the Bush the first, but, you know, there was the quick invasion of Panama, the overthrow of the government of Haiti, bombing Sudan, the intervention in Somalia. All of these didn't go perfectly, but basically the United States had their way. And so Afghanistan, right, the initial months or, you know, year or two of the war in Afghanistan seemed to be going their way. There was, you know, minimal compared to what there was, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years later, minimal U.S. ground presence, minimal U.S. casualties in Afghanistan. And they thought, great, we're just going to keep rolling across the Middle East. Donald Rumsfeld infamously said, the war in Iraq will take 6 days, 6 weeks, I doubt 6 months. Of course, it's still going on now, almost 14 years later. But the fact was that, no, they did not win. They anticipated that Iraq would be a springboard to Syria, right? Also Iran, also Libya, perhaps Sudan. But the Iraqi people's resistance stopped them in their tracks.
John White, Wesley Clark, General Wesley Clark, and he was in charge of U.S. forces during the bombing of Yugoslavia and the destruction eventually of Yugoslavia. He said that, and this is kind of a famous quote, but I want to help the audience, people who might not have heard it in the past. It was from 2005 when he was interviewed, I think actually with Amy Goodman on Democracy Now!, but General Clark went on and he was recounting what things were like after September 11th. And he talked about he had testified in Congress in 2002. And then he said he had made a trip back to the Pentagon. I want to read to you from the interview and what Wesley Clark said, because I think it's extremely instructive about what has happened since. So here's Clark. So I came back to see him a few weeks later. This is, again, 2002. And this is another Pentagon commander. And by that time, we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, are we still going to war with Iraq? Again, this was right after September 11th. And he said, oh, it's worse than that. He reached over on his desk. He picked up a piece of paper and he said, I just got shown this from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office. That would be Donald Rumsfeld at the time. I got it today. And then he goes on, this is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran. I mean, this is Clark talking about what he was told in 2001, 2002, before the Iraq invasion. John White, your comments on that?
Well, that was a rare example of honesty from within the belly of the beast, wasn't it? I mean, I think what we have to understand is that the people who've been responsible for the carnage that we've seen since 9/11, these are not rational human beings. These are crazed neocons. These are white, privileged, expensively educated savages, and there's no other word to describe them. These people have done so much damage to the Middle East, to the global South, that history will not be kind. It will issue a withering indictment, such as was leveled against even the likes of Hitler and other dictators who've had these grand plans for reshaping the world. As we know, the demise of the Soviet Union has been an unmitigated disaster for the entire world, for working people in the West, and also and especially for people across the global South. And this is why we've seen at this point in our history such intensity surrounding the Battle of Aleppo, because the Syrian conflict, of all those conflicts that have ensued since 9/11, the Syrian conflict is the most seminal. And that's really saying something when you think of the damage caused in Iraq and in Libya and so forth, because this is a turning point, because this is multipolarity in evidence. When Vladimir Putin took to the rostrum at the 70th UN General Assembly on September 28th, 2015, he he announced the birth of a multipolar world, and it's now come to fruition. And now this is why we're seeing a huge campaign of disinformation surrounding the Battle of Aleppo. And this is because the stakes involved are so high, and they know they're so high. They know not only is Syria going to be saved as a secular, non-sectarian state. And by the way, just in parenthesis, the attempt to depict the Syrian Arab Army, which, as Eva said previously, is a reflection of the mosaic, the multicultural, multi-religious mosaic that is Syrian society. The attempt to depict them as a latter-day Waffen-SS, an army of occupation going around murdering civilians at will, and conversely the attempt to rehabilitate Nusra Front and other Al-Qaeda permutations as latter-day partisans or French resistance, this has been absolutely preposterous. But this is what's been happening. And people like Eva have now become the story because they're being attacked for daring to deviate from this Western narrative. And not only Eva, people such as Stephen F. Cohen, Professor Emeriti of Princeton University, Peter Ford, who was mentioned, Vanessa Beely, Tim Anderson, Patrick Coburn, and Robert Fisk of The Independent. So being swept up in this ideological assault are elements within the progressive community. Amy Goodman is one, and others who've wilted under this ideological assault. So this reflects the stakes involved in Syria. And General Wesley Clark was, as I say, is a rare example. Maybe he had a crisis of conscience and he's come out from the dark side and he's found his humanity again. But I don't know. But it's certainly of a piece with what's happened. And we obviously understand the contents of the infamous Project for a New American Century, which really was the blueprint for this this grand strategy of cementing Washington's unipolarity. We're talking about a modern-day Roman Empire, and these people are not going away, but they're certainly suffering a huge defeat. And what we're seeing, as I say, is the rise of a multipolar alternative to the unipolar status quo we've had. And this is what's driving Trump's more kind of pragmatic turn, because he understands it's not that he doesn't want to have a US empire, I don't think. I think he realises it's now unsustainable, and that they have to retreat and they have to contract and they have to retrench. How that will work out in practice, I don't know. I did mention that there are deep state elements within Washington who are committed to maintaining the status quo. There are vested interests. There's a massive network of think tanks and there's an economic imperative behind the status quo. But it's now unsustainable. And this is why Trump's election was seminal. But this is why Syria has been so seminal, and certainly in terms of the geopolitical importance and for historical importance.
We're talking about Syria. We're talking about the liberation of Aleppo, what it means for the people in Syria, what it means for the people in Aleppo, and also what is going to happen going forward in the region, this war-torn region of the Middle East. War-torn, of course, because the United States and its allies in the West have made war against the Middle East. And as John White just said, perhaps the liberation of Aleppo and Syria will be the seminal turning point in this region's destiny, at least in modern times. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. Today we are joined for the full hour by Eva Bartlett. She's an independent journalist. She's talking to us from Ontario, Canada. We're joined from Scotland by John White. He is the host of Radio Sputnik's weekly show, Hard Facts, and in studio by Walter Smolarek. He is the show producer for Loud and Clear. Eva Bartlett, before we went to the break, John White was talking about the fact that the dominant narrative in the Western mainstream media is pivotal to trying to shape public opinion. And it seems to be in a sort of frenzied state because on the ground in Syria, the narrative, in fact, has been sort of disproven. It's frayed in reality because while the mantra has been Assad must go, etc., Assad's not going. The Assad government, the Syrian government, the Syrian Arab Army have demonstrated that they have both internal political support sufficient to remain in power and sufficient international support from Russia, from Iran, from Hezbollah in Lebanon. They're not going. That's not going down. So now, as John White mentioned, the media narrative, again, in this great frenzied disappointment, is starting to attack independent journalists like you who have been to Syria, who have been courageous enough and strong enough to actually say what you've seen, to talk to people who whose voices are never heard in the mainstream media. Talk about the assault going on against the independent journalists who are saying something different than the dominant narrative.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. I'm aware of a couple of well-known sites that have launched smear campaign type attacks on myself and also on Vanessa Bealey. Channel 4 is a UK channel, and for some reason it does have quite a large following on social media. And I say for some reason rather pointedly, because they, in my opinion, and not only mine, but I would say the opinion of people who are following, most people who are following what's happening in Syria, Channel 4 has been one of the main UK propaganda channels putting forth, you know, reports on the so-called white helmets and, you know, basically alleging that these are rescuers, and we can get into that in a moment. But in fact, Channel 4 has been largely reporting the propaganda of al-Nusra-embedded so-called rescuers and al-Nusra terrorists themselves. Channel 4 is one of the ones that's led an attack on me. As far as I know, they've had two pieces in the past week on me, and the other one, and I'm going to get to both these, the other outlet that has launched an attack on me, one that I know of, is called Snopes. Now, both these attacks came after I did a UN press conference. So one thing I want to make clear at first is that this conference, although at least Snopes, I believe Channel 4 also, are painting it as, or they're portraying it as, a conference that the Syrian government organized and that I was a puppet spokesperson at, for both the Syrian government and the Russians, because they're both saying I work for apparently both these governments. Number one, I actually initiated that conference, and basically I did it after a U.S. Peace Council group had back from Syria after they visited for a week this summer, and they had given a talk back, a report back. So I actually contacted the appropriate person in the Syrian mission at the UN, and I said, look, I have a lot of experience on the ground. I'd like to share it in this venue. So they said that they would be happy to try to facilitate this upon my request. And then actually afterwards it was taken up by both the U.S. Peace Council and the Hands Off Syria Coalition in the U.S., who themselves did, you know, worked out the details of when the conference would occur. And I'll note that I believe it was Snopes, somebody made a comment about it being organized by Syrian Ambassador Al-Jafri, and yes, he did help facilitate it. People have noted he wasn't present that day, and there's a reason. The stunt pulled by the Canadian representative at the UN General Assembly calling for a resolution to be passed that day, and it in itself was another resolution simply meant to vilify the governments in Russia. However, anyway, Ambassador Al-Jafri was not present. I gave, my own take on, a very short and brief take on what I'd seen in Syria and to do with the media lies as well, and other people on the panel gave their own thoughts. Anyway, so at one point I did mention a couple of facts. One thing I mentioned was that children have been used in war propaganda, and I was referring to reports that have been seen in different mainstream media of a girl that looks very similar. At one point, she's called Aya. And my point was that it seems very clear that this could be false reporting on Syria, using children to purport that the Russians or the Syrians are murdering in Aleppo or wherever they're reporting. Now, Snopes, there's a meme going around on the Internet. And so Snopes and Channel 4 both said, I was going, what I said was, they were basically taking the points made in the meme and saying that these were my words. My point was that it's not clear whether this reports of this girl are manufactured or not, but it's highly likely and highly probable for various reasons. One, usually the images show up in videos put forth by the White Helmets, who, as we know, are funded by the West to a tune of at least $100 million. And another point being that we have seen evidence, and this has actually come out in the last week, I believe The Independent reported on this as well, of staged photos. And there was an incident just this week in Egypt in which people that were staging photos, purporting to be in Aleppo, staging videos, were arrested. And this is not the first time. We've seen that children have been used in propaganda regarding Syria, and I can point to the incident of East Ghouta in 2013, in which in videos analyzed by Mother Agnes Mariam and the ICE team's support, they found that children in some videos, and this was all alleging that the Syrian army had used chemical weapons on the people in Ghouta, they found that children in the videos had been shown in one video purporting to be in one area and in another video purporting to be another area, the same children. So my point was that it's quite likely that there has been use of this girl. I can't prove it definitively, but it seems quite likely that this girl has been used in different reports to criminalize or vilify the Syrian and Russian governments. That was one point. Yeah, the whole attempt to portray me as a spokesperson for the Syrian or Russian governments. Now, just because I have contributed, I think, a total of 8 op-eds to RT in the past 7 or 8 years, half of which were from occupied Palestine when I lived in Gaza, the fact that I have contributed to RT in some people's eyes makes me basically a reporter for Russia. And obviously this is not true. My question would be, why do these people that are alleging these things, that I'm basically a state propagandist for Russia, even though, again, I want to highlight this point, what I have said and the terms that I use, if one has the moral integrity to actually go to Syria and speak with Syrians, you'll find that they are saying the same thing. So essentially, all these people are Russian agents. The other point I want to make is, why, when journalists that work for BBC, which is a state-owned channel, or Al Jazeera, which is a state-owned channel, why are these journalists not called, Qatari propagandists or UK propagandists? It's simply a way to, detract from what I'm actually saying. The other point I want to make about Channel 4, again, they highlight in on this, so they might be right to investigate what I've said about this girl who's sometimes called Aya. It's certainly good to look at this and see whether there's any merit to what I'm saying. However, why did Channel 4 not talk about other things that I mentioned, including the White Helmets, which Channel 4 themselves continue to laud as noble rescuers, when we know that they're not rescuers? We know that they are simply a propaganda group. And why does Channel 4 not look at any of the other critical points that I mentioned in the report back, including the 11,000 civilians that have been murdered by Western-backed rebels over the last 4 or 5 years? And the reason they haven't, and the reason that they're doing these smear campaigns, not just against me, but also Vanessa Bealey, and then you have people like the Louis Proyects of the world that go after basically anybody, or the Steven Zunas of the world that go after anybody who's been on the ground and try to discredit them. The point is, they don't want this information to be said, so they're actually trying to discredit us by tainting our name.
Yeah, guilt by association. Here, of course, our show, Loud and Clear, it's on Radio Sputnik. We say a lot of things against Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party, and we say a lot of things against Donald Trump and the Republican Party. Nobody can possibly, having listened to our show or Eugene Perrier's show, By Any Means Necessary, or Unanimous Dissent, all these shows produced in Washington, D.C., seriously say that we're pro-Trump or anything like that, and certainly not taking our direction from the Russian government or Vladimir Putin, as is alleged. I mean, Walter, it really is sort of the old witch hunt come back. I mean, anybody who speaks against the dominant narrative is an agent of Russia. I mean, that's the big mantra now. It's so dominating, and the Democratic Party and even a significant section of the liberal establishment are completely embracing it. It's sort of like the liberals and the Democrats are now sounding like the Ronald Reagan Republicans in the 1980s. I mean, they reversed position. But all that said, the truth is, the reality is, in spite of the media presentation, the United States is losing its position in a big way, it seems to me, in the Middle East. And I want to go back to the geostrategic impact, not only because we had the liberation of Aleppo, but the day after Russia's ambassador to Turkey was assassinated, Turkey nonetheless went forward with a summit in Moscow with Russia and with Iran and without John Kerry and without the United States. And Russia and the United States have been, quote, partnering and having all of these discussions, Geneva, Vienna, blah, blah, blah. But John Kerry wasn't invited. And then the three countries issued a proclamation, a declaration, and it said, quote, Iran, Russia, and Turkey express their readiness to facilitate and become the guarantors of the prospective agreement being negotiated between the Syrian government and the opposition, which, of course, does not include the terrorist part of the opposition. Now, that sounds to me like Turkey has agreed to drop the Assad must go demand. As John White had said in the beginning, perhaps Erdogan is the big loser in terms of his earlier policy. But Walter, does the new tripartite cooperation leave the United States more or less out of the equation when it comes to a final resolution of the war in Syria? And of course, Donald Trump in Cincinnati said, we want to create safe zones in Syria, which I don't think that would have occurred to Donald Trump if James Mad Dog Mattis and some of the other Pentagon generals he's including in his cabinet had not sort of included him in that discussion.
Yeah, I agree with John that Erdogan is a big loser. And I think the United States, if you look at sort of the arc of the last, you know, 15 years or so of U.S. intervention in the Middle East, are big losers as well. I mean, if you told Donald Rumsfeld in like February 2003 that the ultimate result of all of what he was about to do would be a joint operation center between Syria, Iran, and Russia set up in Baghdad, he would faint. You know, I mean, it's such a completely different outcome than what they desired, which was stable proxy regimes set up across the region. And of course, the United States still has the capacity to inflict tremendous suffering on the people of the Middle East. I mean, Libya is a clear example of that. Of course, Syria, hundreds of thousands of people dead. In Iraq, you know, genocidal level deaths caused by the U.S. invasion. It was a genocide. But what we see now, I mean, with the battlefield developments in Syria, with the battlefield developments in Iraq and the composition of forces there, where some of the former resistance fighters who had fought against the U.S. occupation are now participating alongside the Iraqi security forces in the liberation of Mosul. And of course, this diplomatic development, the Turkey-Iran-Russia summit, is that the forces in the region, the forces that are aligned with forces in the region, are capable of coming to political conclusions and political resolutions on their own without the United States. We'll have to see how this goes. I mean, Turkey appears to have made the calculation that the cost of the war in Syria to them has just been too much, and that they'll sort of focus on, you know, maybe Erdogan wants to focus on establishing his executive dictatorial presidency, turn more inward, crushing the Kurdish resistance in the southeast. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states will back off of their extremely belligerent policy in Syria, but it certainly, I think, shows that the trend is towards the isolation of the United States in the region, and perhaps greater dialogue and maybe a peace process that exists parallel to the continued military struggle against the terrorist elements operating in Syria that are now concentrated in Idlib.
John White, you called Syria seminal to the Middle East. We're coming to the end of 2016, the beginning of 2017. It's clear that the Assad government is here to stay. It's not going to certainly be ousted by the armed struggle. Aleppo is liberated. We've been talking about the Iran-Russia-Turkey agreement. But I want to ask you about what an Iran-Russia-Turkey arrangement might mean for the Kurds, because Turkey has made it quite clear that the thing that they mostly oppose is any kind of Kurdish zone, whether it's an autonomous zone or a de facto autonomous zone or part of a federalized Syria. And at the same time, the United States has been fighting along with the YPG and the Kurdish units. Is it possible that Iran-Russia-Turkey agreement will be at the expense of the Kurds, who have been seen as valiant, heroic fighters like in Kobani and elsewhere against ISIS? What's your take on the Kurdish situation?
Well, probably along with the Palestinians, the Kurds are the biggest victims of Sykes-Picot, the imperialist agreement that was drawn up, and then the Balfour Declaration on the back of that, just towards the end of the First World War. You know, they're the largest stateless nationality ethnic group in the world today. I think there are around 30 million people, most of them in Turkey, split between Turkey, Syria, Iraq and Iran. I think inevitably they will lose out in this regard, because Turkey is in no mind to give way to any talk of any autonomous Kurdish zone or territory and on its border, because it's worried about how it'll impact on its large Kurdish minority in Turkey itself. The Iranians would not be minded to do so either. The Kurds, I think, have played a very bad hand in aligning themselves with the Americans, American imperialism, to try and achieve their aims. As I think I discussed this with you a few weeks ago. They certainly haven't learned the lessons from the first Gulf War, when they rose up at the behest of George H.W. Bush then, and they were left hanging in the wind. And I think the Americans will do the same again. I don't think the Americans have the power to guarantee the Kurds anything. And I think the Kurds have made a mistake in aligning, as I say, their interests with the Americans in their focus on Raqqa. I do think Raqqa is very important to the Americans. They've made that clear. And what we have to establish is that everything America is doing in Syria is illegal under international law. They are not there legally. they are subverting the sovereignty of the Syrian government. So, you know, but their intent on maintaining, I think, a foothold in Syria with a view on the post-conflict situation, helping to liberate Raqqa. They're struggling in Mosul as of now, but this is why I think Obama lifted the restrictions on arming opposition groups, which is a very, very serious development a few weeks ago, unconscionable. Many observers say this is so he can arm the Kurds with a view on that assault on Raqqa, but that was not stipulated in when he made the decision. That was the Kurds never came up. It was just an open-ended decision to lift this restriction. So many, myself included among those, are worried that he's also looking to perhaps arm so-called moderates who are in conflict with the Syrian government. So there's still a very murky situation. It's still a very messy situation. There's still many strands that need to be tied up. We do know that Assad government has survived. The threat of overthrow has gone. Russia's commitment has seen to that. The Syrian Arab Army, extraordinary tenacity and courage, have saved their country as a non-sectarian state. And I think it's important to understand this, Brian, is that this is not a conflict between Sunni, Shia, Muslim and non-Muslim. This is a conflict in the region between sectarian and non-sectarian forces. And so this is why we have Saudi Arabia, which, along with Israel, is two sectarian states in that region. And that vision has been blunted by the victory of the Syrian Arab Army, which is another reason why this is such a seminal conflict, because it draws a line on this pattern of regressive movements able to dominate the region, able to dominate the trajectory of the region, and that's ended now. So Russia's commitment has been very, very crucial in this regard. I don't think Syria would probably have survived if it wasn't for Russia's intervention. But something else we need to understand is Muslims have done most of the suffering in this conflict, and they've also done most of the fighting. And this is where we have to look at the situation with regards to this anti-Muslim hysteria, this Islamophobia that's been whipped up by Trump, by Brexit and so forth, by right-wing movements across Europe. This is a very, very narrow view, and we have to fight against that narrative, because we can stand with Muslims. Muslims stand with us, and it's Muslims of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, Hezbollah, the majority of soldiers in the Syrian Arab Army, they are the ones who won this victory on the ground, and they've done it in alliance with Russia. And that's a very important point
Let's leave it there, because we are sadly out of time. We've been joined from Ontario, Canada, by journalist Eva Bartlett. Eva has done remarkable reporting from Syria. She's been there 6 times. She's been to Aleppo. She's now, in fact, because of her coverage, because of her independent truth-telling, has been under attack from the mainstream media. We've also been joined by journalist John White. He's the host of Radio Sputnik's weekly show, Hard Facts. And we've been joined by Walter Smolarek. He is the producer of this show, Loud and Clear. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.